From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I don't grow a lot of roses, just a few favorites, but birds plant the occasional multiflora rose seed here and there around the garden. One of the resulting seedlings looked really strange when I noticed it while weeding in an out-of-the-way spot the other day. It was all disfigured and red, and uh-oh, rose rosette disease comes to my corner of Nowheresville. Rose rosette is today's subject, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
I hear from a lot of you who have encountered rose rosette disease, not on some weed as I did, but on your prized rose bushes. And so I invited research scientist Christina King of Star Roses and Plants, known for more than a century for many favorite garden plants, including the most popular roses today, the Knockout series, to come explain what this disease is all about and what promise lies ahead for fighting it. Welcome to the program, Christina. I'm so grateful that you made the time today for this.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So as a background, just briefly, can you tell us a little bit about Star Roses and Plants and about yourself? Your journey there was a little different. You weren't intending to be a rose person particularly. I think you did your PhD in some fascinating aspect of conifer reproduction or something. So
I did.
Yeah.
So I've been interested in plants since I was a kid. And then through college, figured out how I could actually make a career out of plants.
Yes.
And I started at Star Roses about 6 years ago. And they had a research project in rose, and it was similar. The molecular kind of fancy science part was similar to my PhD work. So I got on board with them. And ironically, my middle name is Rose.
Oh.
So it seemed to be the perfect fit.
Oh, kismet. Okay.
Rose can be a difficult thing, but I was used to it from working in conifers. Conifers certainly aren't front and center and the hot new plant, so... but roses are much prettier.
And so Star Roses, as I mentioned in the introduction, well known for many different plant series, including the Knockout Roses. So this is, you know, a good part of Star's business, I assume, is roses, meaning rose rosette disease is a big concern to this company and to other companies in the industry. And I think the industry is kind of working together in recent years to try to figure out what to do. And you even hosted a webinar recently on the topic with various universities and other companies, I believe. And I can give a link to that. So kind of let's do a little short history of the disease. I mean, where did it come from? When was it first discovered?
So the disease, it's not an invasive disease. It is part of America. So they first noticed it on some species roses in the Rockies around the 1940s, but it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't in someone's prized rose garden. It was just in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But then it started to spread to the Great Plains when they started introducing multiflora rose. It was planted a lot in the 60s as a hedgerow and just kind of spread across the country. It followed multiflora rose across there. And as we all know, multiflora rose got a little out of control.
Yes.
And so then the disease is able to just use that as a host. And then it's been just moving up the eastern seaboard in the last couple decades. And people really started noticing it because we love roses so much.
Right.
And it started popping up outside of these species roses.
Now, just to backtrack a minute, not everyone may know multiflora rose. So it was, as you said, brought, I don't remember where it's native to, but it was introduced as a hedgerow, sort of like for farm, the boundaries of farms and so forth, to be used as a hedge. Is that what it was for?
That was one of the big uses for it.
Yeah. And it really did, like many invasive plants, over time, the first intention was good, but the result was bad. And if you look at the maps of the range of multiflora rose, it's sort of now the same map of the spread of rosette disease, right? It like leaped and hopped.
Right, yeah. There's a slight time gap, but you can see it definitely follows the same progression across the country.
Right. So what causes, you said this is a native disease, this is not some imported insect or imported pathogen from another country like we hear about so many times today with other things. So this is a native disease. How does it work?
So the disease is caused by a virus, and there's a tiny, tiny mite that carries the virus that feeds and lives on roses. It's a windblown mite, so a nice gust of wind moves it around, or we have problems sometimes if you're in a landscape, you're using a leaf blower, that can also blow it around.
Oh, geez.
So the little mites can get the virus when they feed on the plant, and then when they go to the next rose, then when they feed on that plant, then they move that virus along. And then the mites also lay their eggs in the roses, and they'll overwinter there. So then in the spring, when the new mites hatch, they'll feed and then slowly can move the disease that way.
Right. And windblown, I mean, you're not kidding. It really moves. It can move distances. Unlike the mite left to its own devices, it doesn't, like, walk along a million miles an hour. It really gets on a breeze and gets going. So the mite is the vector, yes, of the, and it kind of balloons on the wind from place to place.
Yes, they've even found it in snow. They did some studies on some rooftops and found that it could travel in the little water droplets of snow. So it's a persistent little bugger.
Yeah. So what other, so I mentioned before that the industry is kind of, I mean, the rose industry has to get together to work on this because how long has it kind of been a problem in cultivated roses? And you know, kind of what's a little bit of history of that?
So we first really started talking about it just a little bit about 6 years ago that we heard some reports. It really wasn't a big deal yet. It just kind of sprung up, and it was some researchers had just started studying exactly what was causing it. So Star Roses just jumped on it quickly just so we could be ahead of the disease, because a lot of the times it's when you're starting to lose massive, you know, trees or crops or
yes,
anything that people really start paying attention. So we tried to be as proactive as we could and talk to other industries, talk to some government agencies, talk to universities. We held an RRD summit. It was 5 or 6 years ago, just to start getting all of these people together to start talking about them and put together an action plan. And that actually led to a group of a bunch of different universities were able to get a big research grant. It's a specialty crops grant from the USDA.
Yes.
And we're, Star Roses is one of the industry supporters of it, and they have other rose growers in there, and then people from the USDA as well, so that we can tackle the disease both from a research point and an industry point, and also then try and get consumers and growers and just, you know, people that are buying roses for their health to help report where they see it so we can stop the spread, get samples and do testing and just really try to figure out what's going on with the disease and how we can work to stop it.
Right. On the recent webinar that you guys hosted, and again, I'll give the YouTube, you know, file for that so people can watch if they want more information. I think some universities like that were involved in that research. I think, University of Florida, Texas, maybe Oklahoma, Delaware. I'm probably missing some, but I think those were some of the main characters as well, besides Star and other industry players.
Yeah, and they've been able to do some great work.
Yeah, Tennessee another one? Maybe that's another one.
Tennessee, yeah, and Tennessee has been doing a lot of trials with cultivated roses to see, is there anything on the market already that is resistant or can tolerate the disease a little better?
Yeah, so we'll talk about that in a sec because that's really interesting. I think I learned on the webinar that, and you kind of alluded to this, you said in the last 6 or so years it's kind of become more of an awareness. So even though in the 1940s in the West there was this thing, this disease, it didn't even get the virus didn't even get identified, I think, until 2011. So
right, yeah, that's when they said this is caused by a virus.
Right, right, right. So kind of interesting, like the phenomenon had been observed, but it hadn't even been fully understood. So you were saying, like University of Tennessee is looking into which roses do better or worse against it. We know that multiflora rose is a vector. Are there other species or types of roses that seem to be more or less susceptible that we know already? Or?
So we do know a few species roses mm-hmm. that do appear to be resistant.
Oh.
They've been doing testing. They put them in with their trials. And it looks like there are some species. So it looks like in rose genetics there is resistance somewhere. We have some of our consultants that have been, going to the same fishing hole for 20 years and have seen these roses and have never seen RRD on them. So there is hope that it's there. The trials for the varieties that are the commercial ones, we're still waiting to hear. They want to make sure, they have a few years worth of data so that we know for sure that when they say yes or no, that it's good solid data.
What are some of the species that seem to have some promise? Do you, off the top of your head,
there's a couple of species. There's the swamp rose, which is Rosa palustris.
Sure.
Which looks like it has it. I don't remember the common names.
That's okay.
Rose patigera looks like it might be. And there's a couple others where they think so. The initial tests are looking good, so they're trying to see there and looking at the DNA, too, to see if they can actually, is there a gene, is there something we can pinpoint genetically that would help with research.
Right. So I said in the introduction, so I'm up weeding the outer reaches of I have a few acres, and I'm out at the far boundary, and I find a multiflora seedling, as I do many times, that the birds have ingested, I guess, some fruit and, pooped it out and planted seedlings. And I'm in an agricultural area, so that's, one of the things, along with bittersweet and barberry and who knows what else, that I have as a weed. And I noticed this strange one stem, so to speak, didn't even look like a normal stem. It was kind of red and different looking. Tell us about what this RRD, it has its own acronym, rosette disease, what it looks like how do we recognize it?
So in the early symptoms, you'll usually start to see a reddish kind of growth mm-hmm. At the tops of the plants, and they'll start to get an excessive amount of thorns. And it's kind of a relative because some roses are a little thornier than others. But
right.
If it looks like it has more thorns than it normally should, that's usually a good sign in the early stages. And they'll get a little overly tender. Usually as your roses, sometimes the leaves start out a little red when you get some new growth. We see it on knockouts. That's one of their characteristics. But they'll turn green once they start, once later in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But when the red doesn't go away and they get really thorny and they, like you said, they just look weird. Something is off on them.
Yes.
That's usually a pretty good indicator. You'll also see that if they do have buds on them, the flowers don't bloom right. They look a little smushed and
mm-hmm.
they don't open all of the way.
Mm-hmm.
You might see that the shoots just get really long and scraggly looking. And there are some instances, if you know you've been spraying some kind of weed killer or any herbicide, sometimes it's mistaken for herbicide damage.
Right.
But that'll you'll just get a little red. It'll just get a look a little roughed up. But these,
mm-hmm.
especially the thorniness and the deformed flowers are usually a sign.
Okay.
But if you're a homeowner, you usually know when you've been spraying things.
Right.
So it's a little easier.
Right. So I see this thing, or people see some disfigurement of the nature you just described on a cultivated rose they have in their garden. And then what? What do we do? What should we do? People write to me a lot and ask me this. And so I'm asking you, what's the tactical steps that we need to take?
So the best thing to do to stop the spread, especially if you have other roses or your neighbors have roses,
mm-hmm.
is just to remove the whole plant.
Right.
Just grab a garbage bag, stick it over the plant, and you can cut the plant off at the bottom, tie those up, and then you can dig out the roots after that to make it a little easier.
Okay.
We don't recommend pruning out just the diseased
right.
Shoot because you can see that it'll come back. It can live in the base of the plant.
Okay.
So, we recommend you just remove the whole plant, and you can plant a new rose right away. The disease can't live in the soil, so that's good news.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is good news. I mean, we have to look for the silver lining in some of these things, exactly. Don't we, Christina? We'll take any
right.
good
news. So you can go out and you can plant a new rose the next day.
Okay.
And it'll be fine.
Okay. Is there anything preventive besides immediately removing and destroying, as you just described, an infected plant? Is there any other preventive tactical stuff that we should be doing, or not so far we don't have any?
One of the best things, and it'll help with other rose diseases as well, is just giving your roses a nice prune, either late winter, early spring, right after that threat of the hard frosts are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Cut them back. You can go about a third of the way down so that they're about 12 to 18 inches tall. It'll remove all of the dead blooms and the old wood, which is where the mites like to overwinter.
Oh.
So if you can get that source, then hopefully then any of the eggs that are there, or the females that are resting there, then they won't be able, you'll remove them, and that can help just the spread so that you get rid of all that dead material.
It sounds like we might
want to
destroy that material also, not compost or put it in our brush
exactly.
pile or whatever. So extra good sanitation sounds important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just keeping your plants healthy, keeping your roses healthy in general, it just gives them a kind of better fighting chance
right.
for roses at disease and other pests that are out there for roses as well.
Right. You just mentioned a little bit about pruning, and I wonder about one, just I can sort of segue and say, one group of roses, or I don't know if we call it a class of roses, the climbers, do we prune those after they bloom? I'm in the Northeast, and people are listening from all over the country, but I've always heard with those we wait till after the bloom. I mean, clean them up in the spring, but more let them do their thing and then have at them. Do you have any point of view on that?
The climbers, generally for climbers, we just prune them just to keep their shape.
Yes.
Or if they're getting too tall for you, they don't need that cut back to rebloom.
Right.
You generally do need the tops for them to bloom, so it is better to do it later in the season.
Oh, that's
so that you
why.
Don't lose your bloom.
Oh, it's because because I wondered, you know, of course I should have just thought it through, but yeah, because I have one boy that it's turning into quite the behemoth, and it's going to get a haircut in about 2 weeks after it finishes its bloom cycle. I think not even a haircut. It's going to get some of the oldest canes taken out to the base, I think, because
sure.
some of them are quite substantial in an old climbing
they
rose.
They can keep going. Yes.
Yeah. 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 So, what are some of the research? And you touched on this a little bit, but what are the main things? There are some people who are looking into which species are resistant, where in the gene pool to get. Good, strong genetics to breed in. What else is being looked at? Any other angles on the rose-rosette research?
So they're looking at better ways just to diagnose rose-rosette disease. So whether it's something where you can actually just, you know, send in a leaf and they can do a genetic test on it, or they're working towards being able to send out test strips so we can send them to rose growers, or maybe they're hoping maybe even, you know, you could take these little strips, use them in your backyard, and you can say, oh, yes, this does or doesn't. So just being able to easily diagnose it. So from the grower point, before it even gets to the store to buy, that they can say this does or this doesn't have rose rosette disease. So just trying to stop it as early as they can so that it's not spreading.
Would you call that virus indexing or something? Is that what
it would be? Yeah, it would be part of the virus indexing. Right?
Because, like with, for instance, cannas, there's viruses that affect cannas, and I think with a number of kinds of popular bulbs. And so that's always a big problem when a commercial horticultural crop has some virus, you know, merchants, and then below that, the homeowner, you know, the recipient consumer at the other end. They don't want it, so we want to know something's been virus indexed, it's been checked for viruses. So you guys are trying to do that at your end in order not to have it trickle down into
exactly.
the stream. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that we know from the beginning, you know, at each move, it is, we're just moving clean material.
Right.
So they're working on that, and to just make it easier and more cost efficient to do on a wide scale.
Huh.
So there's been a big push. I know they're hoping to have a lot more information during the summer. They're doing some more testing. So hopefully they'll be able to bring something to market by the end of the year, I think, is their hope.
Uh-huh.
And then along with that is, of course, just looking at, like you had mentioned before about the, you know, just seeing, are there genes out there? Are they able to breed for resistance? So there's a few grad students at Texas A&M that is one of the big places they're looking at it. To see, they're making these huge populations, looking at the DNA, seeing what they can pull out to see, you know, if we can identify some varieties or some species that are resistant, can we breed that in into some of the more popular, aesthetically pleasing? Some of the species can be a little wild looking, so hopefully we can obtain them with some of our commercial varieties.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it's even going into some, what are the best management practices so that we can, they can give information to landscapers and growers and homeowners on just what's the best way to take care of your roses. And then they're looking into, since it is a mite that spreads the disease, you know, are there can we actually fight the mite as well?
Mm-hmm.
So looking at miticides and oils and things so we can make recommendations for, you know, for people that are doing these big plantings for landscapes, all the way down to, you know, you and me, where we just want a few in our yard.
Right.
So that kind of everyone can help at whatever level they're at.
Right.
And then just gathering information. And part of this grant that we've been assisting on is just getting people, when they see it, to report it so they can track the spread. And just looking at, you know, creating these information pipelines and looking at the economics of the whole thing, and then just setting up a nice system for monitoring, which just kind of helps the industry as a whole, because it just gives you a piecework. So then, you know, the next big disease that's going to come in 20 years, you know, we can follow a similar idea.
Is there currently, I mean, I know with many things, there is, like with a lot of the downy mildew diseases in, you know, basil most recently and some other crops, there are places where a citizen scientists or professionals can post their data. If they have an outbreak, they can put it in, and it's a real-time mapping system and so forth for the scientists to use. Does that exist for Rose Rosette yet, or is it if I have it?
Yeah. So if you go to roserosette.org.
Oh.
There's a tab on their page, and this is hosted by the universities that are part of this grant have put together this page.
Great.
And there's all kinds of links. You can see all the people working on it, and there's a tab that says reporting, and you can go in and you can say where you found it. You can put a picture of it, and then depending where you are, this also gives the university researchers a chance they could. You can put that if you would be willing to give them a sample.
Okay.
If they would want it, especially if it's somewhere new or somewhere they haven't tested.
Okay.
Because we also want to make sure the virus, that there's only one, you know, if the virus mutates or something, so it's good. And you can look, there's maps, and you can kind of see where it is, if it is near you. Or if you're just looking for more information.
Right.
There's a lot on that page.
Well, see, it's a good thing that I called you in time, research scientist Christina King of Star Roses and Plants, because to talk about Rose Rosette when I saw my first discovery, because I'm in kind of, as I said in the intro, nowheresville. So maybe I can make a report in a new area, unfortunately, but maybe that could be of value. I'm so glad to speak to you. I really do appreciate your taking the time to explain this to me. I think I have a little better grasp. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks to all of you for tuning in, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden or instagram.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.